Hey, this is WTOP film critic Jason Fraley, and we are being joined by, just say your name and your title with the film.
I'm Ben Lewin, and this is Judy Levine, and the film is Falling for Figaro.
Ben is the writer-director, and I'm the producer.
People will remember, of course, your film that you directed and produced, The Sessions, a few years back. That got a lot of acclaim. So if you like that, check this one out. Why don't we, before we get too far in, just hit them with the premise really fast. What's the basic, log line?
A girl wants to chuck her job in finance to become an opera singer, signs up with the singing teacher from hell, and finds herself falling in love with her competition, and who in the process discovers that in order to learn to sing, you have to have a broken heart.
No. Well, I mean, that's quite the juxtaposition, the world of finance and the world of opera. How do you juxtapose those, visually?
Oh, very briefly. We get that she's kind of doing a job, come to a sort of a threshold in her life, decides this is the moment. So you get a sense of the opening of the movie that, there's something brewing inside her and about to hatch. So, we leave the world of finance fairly quickly.
It's not gritty. She's sort of pretty high flying in the world of finance, so she can afford to take this risk in her life.
She has expensive luggage.
Yeah, she's privileged. She's privileged, but the lead actress Danielle McDonald is absolutely terrific in the role, and really brings a very sort of an authentic, human kind of portrayal of it. And Danny, I don't know if you're familiar with her work from Dumplin' and Patty Cakes. She did Dumplin' with Jennifer Aniston, Patty Cakes, where she plays a rap singer. She has quite a high profile through the Sundance Film Festival. And then she was in a terrific series called Unbelievable with Toni Collette. And she's just the camera loves her. She's a natural on screen. But, this is not your typical kind of tall, thin, romantic couple.
Not Ken and Barbie.
Definitely not Ken and Barbie. I mean, Hugh Skinner is good looking, but in a slightly quirky way. He's one of those people where you look at him and you think, oh, he's good looking. And then if you look for a while, you start to think, oh, well, a little odd here and there. But they're great together. And Joanna Lumley just, from Absolutely Fabulous, Ab Fab, is this, wonderful, very, very sort of textured singing teacher from hell that completes the triangle of relationships between the three of them. It's great. Really, love the cast.
What makes a singing teacher from hell? Or is it like, J.K. Simmons Whiplash throwing cymbals? Or what's a singing teacher from hell?
Very, very apt comparison. And in the course of making the movie, because we interacted with so many young singers and singing students, we found out that the singing teacher from hell was really the norm. They all had stories about their horrid singing teachers and the terrible things that they did to them. So it was a very identifiable character in a way.
A lot of these young singers that I interviewed, that we know actually, but they all talked about leaving lessons in tears on a regular basis and having a sense of sort of PTSD if they were thought about some of their particular teachers. I mean, their singing teachers are known to be very sort of quite physically brutal. I mean, they, grab you around the rib cage, make you push the piano, do push-ups while you're trying to sing. They can really be very hostile and aggressive for whatever reason they feel that is going to achieve the best results. But a lot of singers will have stories about teachers that have just been brutal. But Joanna brings a lovely sort of, it's done with a sense of humor. So it's, I don't know, it's Whiplash meets some sort of comedy,
an
Ernst Lubitsch film, really.
I love the Ernst Lubitsch reference. What's your favorite Ernst Lubitsch film? I love him. I love that guy.
All of them. Little shop on the corner. Is that
yes,
it?
Yes. Little shop around the corner. Yeah, so good.
Thank you. Yeah, there's one of our favorites.
Trouble in Paradise in 32, or Ninotchka in 39. Yeah. Like, yeah, so many good ones.
There is something a bit old fashioned about the movie in that sense. It does have a kind of Ernst Lubitsch kind of quality. Like to flatter myself thinking so. but it is a bit like that. And really, the music is a major, major part of it. I don't think I ever realized until we were deep into it how much music there is in it, and how much it sort of is part of the story. It's not just kind of underscore. It's very much part of the story, because you see these two people develop into wonderful singers. From a kind of a rusty beginning, and I guess it's a little bit like American Idol or Britain's Got Talent in some ways, in that you have that same sense of they're going for a prize, they've got to prove something.
I like to think of the film as having a bit of it's the sort of the trifecta. You've got comedy, you've got love, and you've got this terrific sort of sense of competition. So we're hoping the audience will be on the edge of their seats, wondering who's going to win. And I always, I find it quite extraordinary if you read articles about the film where the journalists feel absolutely compelled to give away all the spoiler alerts, to give away the secrets of who's going to win and how we did the singing and the this and the that. I think it's lovely to leave all of that and just go in and enjoy it.
They don't say who's going to win, do they? But anyway.
So it does happen actually in a couple of the articles I've read, but that's okay. People should stay away from the press and just go and enjoy the movie. I think people will really come out feeling like they're going to have a bit of joy in their lives, and they get to sing and feel happy which we all could do with at the moment. I think everybody could do with a bit of joy.
Yeah, I'll stay away from any spoilers in our article. So, but stay away from the rest of the press. Just read ours.
There you go. Yes, of course. And listen to the radio.
Yeah, exactly. Well, instead of the Lubitsch touch, it'll be the Ben Lewin touch.
There you go. Thank you very much.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a good uplifting singing story is just what we need. I mean, Coda was similar. That was great too. Obviously with a different angle on it, but yeah, I like those kind of movies.
We haven't been able to see Coda yet. I think we're going to be able to see it here, in about another month or something. We'll have access to it in Australia. Yeah.
Oh, they don't put it on Apple TV there at the same time as the States?
No, not necessarily. And I remember reading that I was going to be able to watch it, but I had a feeling it was still going to be another 2 or 3 weeks or whatever, 4 weeks away.
Right.
Doesn't always work at the same time.
Highly recommend. I mean, you guys know it won Sundance, but it's really hard to do, as you know. It's hard to do a coming of age story, but I think that one, threaded the needle just right between sweet and profound, and sounds like yours does it as well. What tell me about like the actual production, the logistical stuff. Like, how long did it take to shoot? Where did you film?
Well, I think it took us 28 days. We filmed in Scotland. Mostly around, the very famous Loch Lomond. I'll take the high road and you'll take the low road. That song, and I'll be in Scotland. Anyway, it really is very picturesque. The only downside is that we're working in the middle of winter. You don't necessarily know, but it was really cold. And we did sort of interact quite a bit with the locals. So you got a feeling of a place. It was an invented place, but it felt like a real village. And it was all shot around a pub called the Filthy Pig. I wanted to mention there's a real kind of quirky chemistry between the two romantic leads, which is very different from the usual sort of Ken and Barbie stuff. It's a really fascinating chemistry between them.
Oh, well, yeah, there's enough Ken and Barbie movies out there. Let's see something different. Let's see some more realistic couples, you know?
Yeah. No, it's definitely, we wanted to go that way. And
there was a lot of, you know, I've never done a film before with so much music where you had to really plan things around the musical production. And it's quite tricky. I mean, we learned on the fly in many cases.
You know, there was some decision-making to be had about how are we going to, prep the singers. So Hugh Skinner actually had opera singing experience, and he sang in Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, and he had sung in choruses, opera choruses, when he was young. He actually kind of aspired to be an opera singer and is a very capable singer, but not... You know, he hasn't really sung opera for many years and therefore wasn't really strong enough to sort of, you know, carry the film. And so we had repetiteurs who are like opera singing teachers with, you know, they usually play the piano and they talk a lot about body language and breathing and all of those things and how to be sort of how to act as well as sing. And so both Danny and Hugh were able to have a number of sort of lessons with them. And we also had a repetiteur, Beth Jerram, who was on set with us and was there to sort of work with them as well. And it was lovely because we would stay when we were filming out in Luss, which is next to Loch Lomond. We would all stay in this lovely hotel called the Loch Lomond Arms. It was all very Scottish and quaint. And so they could sort of hang out together, Joanna and Hugh and Danny, and build a relationship that way, you know, and Shazad and Gary, the other sort of significant supporting characters. So there was a lot of camaraderie around that, which I think really helped with doing scenes that were really quite challenging. Especially.
Do you remember a film called Billy Elliot?
Of course.
Well, the father from Billy Elliot, Gary Lewis, plays the owner of the pub.
Okay. The filthy pig. He's the filthy pig himself.
He's terrific.
He's very funny. He can just make you laugh by standing there and not saying a thing, you know.
Yeah, he's very wry and dry. And, you know, yeah, sometimes there'd be a line where the character Millie would say something and he would just sort of look at her and this wonderful sort of silence. And, you know, and you can see he's thinking and wondering, well, what am I going to say back to this person, this Londoner, this sort of.
He has the best line in the movie, actually.
He does.
He has the biggest laugh in the movie.
He does get one of the biggest laughs in the movie. Anyway, it's, you know, he's lovely. It's a wonderful balance. There's also this great actor, Shazad Latif, who's very well known over in British television and stuff. Gorgeous looking, who plays the former boyfriend. Well, he's the boyfriend for a while until Millie meets Max. But gorgeous guy, and again, another sort of terrific chemistry, I think, between them.
And there are a couple of wonderful cows who play starring roles.
Oh, yes.
Well.
There's cows? Highland coos, they're referred to as. They're called the Highland coos. Scotland is famous for these big, woolly cows.
You know how on these singing competition shows like Idol, you have these judges?
Simon Cowell, the
cows are the judges.
The cows are the judges, yes.
Oh, okay.
They enjoy listening to the opera. And it's interesting because it's really, the opera in this film is not at all, you know, it's very kind of, it's seductive. It's also very accessible. And we really feel like people will actually really enjoy it in a way that they don't expect to, you know, rather than sort of like, oh, you know, I don't want to see a movie about opera. It's not about opera. It just happens to be set in the world of opera competitions. But the music, you know, we worked very hard to choose songs that were not necessarily absolutely well known, although there's a few that are very identifiable and you hear them in commercials all the time. But there's some duets that they sing that are just so beautiful and melodic, and, you know, and people really enjoy them. You know, the few screenings we've been able to have through the pandemic, people have really loved them. They've come out saying, oh, I didn't know I'd enjoy opera that much, you know, maybe I should listen to a bit more. I wouldn't mind going to an opera. I don't think I've never been to an opera, you know. So it does sort of give people a little insight into that world and some enjoyment of something they think they might not like, but why not? You know, it's It was
I didn't know I'd enjoy opera that much, actually.
Yeah, he actually had much less experience with opera than I did. Yeah, I grew up going to opera.
I actually specialize in making films on subjects I know nothing about.
Yes.
Well, because when you're done, then you do know a lot about it. So.
And a previous film was about a baseball player. I mean, what I know about baseball, you could sort of write on the palm of your hand.
Was it the Catcher and the Spy?
Catcher was a spy.
Yeah.
Ben didn't know a lot about baseball. I mean, not really a baseball movie, right? But he was.
I'm looking for another subject that I know nothing about, so I can make it.
It was the Mo Berg story. But that's good. Now after that, you know more about baseball. After this, you know more about opera. I mean, life is all about growing, right? So.
Yes, absolutely.
It's like going back to school.
We learn from every film we make, actually. There's usually a bunch of stuff that we haven't experienced. And we get to live in lots of different places, which is great. We got to live in Prague for Catcher was a Spy. We got to live in Glasgow when we were making Falling for Figaro. And then now we're living in Perth, Western Australia, while I'm doing How to Please a Woman. It's not complaining. Kids complain every now and again because we go away.
When we were making the sessions, we got to live at home.
Yes, we did. We got to live at home. We got to shoot it in LA and live in our house, which was very nice, actually.
Staycation, yeah.
sort of a staycation. We had a lot of fun making Falling for Figaro. It was really great that we got to do it. You know, the script arrived, you know, in my laptop, you know, in my emails in about 2015, and it's great to have it, you know, done and out. It's challenging to release a film during a pandemic, I have to say. That has not been easy. But it is, you know, we're very thrilled that it's out theatrically in the US. It is on VOD at the same time, but we're hoping people will go to the cinemas. We've been told people are going back to the cinemas there because it's fun to see it on the big screen. And Scotland looks fantastic. You know, it really does look very beautiful in it. So you get to have a little bit of a travelogue as well while you're enjoying the movie.
Awesome. Well, you mentioned the sessions, just memories of that really quick, because I feel like a lot of our listeners will remember that one fondly, but a very interesting storyline in that one, but some big stars you got to work with. Just fond memories of putting that film together.
I think that was a sort of a real kind of turning point for me, because I'd had such a bad few years before it. It was a sort of a period of drought, and I made the sessions really to try and regain some self-respect. I had no idea it would actually be as successful as it was. But I just read an article one day online, and it was a burning bush moment. And I thought, if only I can tell that story on film the way it's just been told to me. So, and really, I guess it set me up as what people call the 40-year overnight success.
Exactly.
But it was.
I think it's interesting to kind of, you know, do something successful when you kind of people think that you're ready to retire, and I kind of in a way I thought, oh well, that's a good warm up.
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly much busier now as we're getting older than we were, you know, when we were younger in our 40s. But
and I can't stand hot young directors. Can't stand them.
They keep getting in the way of us. What we're trying to do, they're scary. No. I'm trying to work with as many young directors as possible, but that's easier as a producer. Obviously, they're just, you know, they're putting Ben out of a job. But but when the sessions came along, I mean, we really didn't have any idea that it would sort of, have the effect and the impact that it had. You know, when we got to Sundance with it, no one had seen it except people who were kind of on the inner circle who were mostly associated with the film. So it was a real shock to us when the first audience at the Eccles was like, you know, 1,200 people, and it was this massive reaction. I think that, selling it, and then suddenly we were in that whirlwind of bidding wars, and then traveling all over the world to all the festivals and winning awards and being treated like royalty. It was really, you know, the sort of that Hollywood dream that you never expect to happen. It's a little bit like lightning in a bottle.
It could go to your head.
Well, it can, but it didn't. I mean, and I do think in
went
the
to
end,
my head.
Yeah, he's hopeless. I'm always trying to kind of, you know, pull that one back. But I think what really made a difference about that film is that it's, you know, and I think lucky if you ever get to do this even once in your life is to make a film that really impacts people's lives. And this film really impacted, you know, I mean, you know, The Sessions really impacted people's lives. It's sort of, you know, one of the things, you know, we were in contact with the woman who runs the only program for training sex surrogates in America. And she said that, you know, within weeks of our film coming out, she was just getting inundated with calls from people who suddenly wanted to be sex surrogates, you know, and parents who would speak to us at screenings and sort of say, look, I've got a kid with a disability. I never knew how to broach the subject of sex with a kid who's got a disability. And a guy who stood up at the Toronto Film Festival in front of 1,500 people and said, I've been a sex surrogate for 30 years and I've never told anyone, right? So he just outed himself there in the spot. And so I think it, you know, and it's still a film that's being referenced. And every now and again, one of our kids will say, particularly our youngest who's just finished uni, that she had friends who would, you know, message her and say, oh, your parents' film is being shown in my sociology class or this or that, you know. So that was really terrific for us. And it did give us a, you know, a sort of a profile in LA that had been hard to kind of really, you know, get sort of solidify, I guess, opened up a lot of doors, especially in terms of casting and all that kind of thing. So things really picked up for us after that. So we have terrific memories of that film. It'll always be, I think, the one that really stood out for us. I mean, very low budget. We didn't get paid a penny while we were making that film. It took a long time for us to see any money for it. But it was a very gratifying, you know, rewarding experience to make that film.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure it was. Well, before we run, plug the other movie that you're talking about, the one that brought you to Australia, How to Please a Woman. Tell us what's that about. Give us a little teaser for that.
Well, it's interesting because I think, you know, the way I tend to describe it doesn't really do it justice because it's, you know, it's about a woman in her 50s who's not feeling fabulous or she's just turning 50. And she ends up taking over a moving company and turning it into house cleaning with benefits. So, you know, you can have your house cleaned by a guy with his shirt off and that's all, or maybe you might want something else. But it's really a film about women, especially women, learning to ask for what they want, still feeling, you know, I don't know what middle age is anymore, but let's say middle age for want of another term, but, you know, reaching middle age and that, you know, society tends to start to treat women like they're invisible at that point and that they're sort of no longer, they're no longer sexy and women want to continue feeling sensual and sexual and attractive and have, you know, sort of exciting sex lives. And the film is about how we should be able to do that.
I hope you don't have children of a tender age listening to your program, do you?
No, this is pre-taped. Don't worry.
That's fine. That's great. Yeah. So anyway, that's what it's about. But it seems to be, we've had a couple of test screenings and it really seems to work across the board. Men really love it as well. Younger women seem to really connect with it, whether or not it may not be about some of those subjects, but they've either seen their mothers going through this or they just recognize the behavior, the interaction between some of the guys and the women. So that's it's got a terrific actress in it called Sally Phillips, who's from England, but people will recognize her from Veep. She plays a very funny Scandinavian politician in Veep. She was in all the Bridget Jones Diaries.
Given her obsessions, you can imagine how difficult life is for me.
Yeah, I'm going to get a reputation for always making movies about things to do with sex, it seems. But yeah.
Falling for Figaro is something that probably everybody can enjoy, I'm sure. All ages,
absolutely.
I'm sure.
Yes. Yes. Ours is pretty tame too, actually. It's a comedy, right. And it's pretty tame. But Falling for Figaro is definitely crosses a lot of demographics in terms of age and appeal. And, you know, it's a feel-good movie. It's a date night movie. It's a movie you could watch with your kids. I think people are going to really enjoy it at the moment. It's great.
Oh, you all don't even worry about it. You all do everything, you know, tastefully, and it's always, it's nicely done. So, so yeah, I mean, everyone's will check out Falling for Figaro. It hits theaters, well, today as we're doing this interview and VOD. Real quick, I guess, final question. How's it been received so far? Didn't it do pretty well at some festivals so far?
Yes. It won the Audience Award at the Berkshire International Film Festival, which is quite a sort of a well-known little indie festival. And it's been getting a lot of, you know, terrific coverage. You know, there's a real enthusiasm for it amongst the people who have seen it. IFC is really, you know, they feel like it's going to do extremely well. And
Bentonville, it also played very well.
It played very well at Bentonville, at Gina Davis's festival, which is very women-centric, that festival. And, you know, we're very excited by it. It's opening up across the, you know, across the country. And what, you know, I mean, it's not James Bond, so it's not in 500 theatres, but it's in a lot of theatres, you know, many more than we expected it to be, because they think people are really going to, you know, get cotton onto it, I guess, is the expression. So we're hoping people will feel safe going into cinemas and seeing the movie.
Absolutely. And a cool chance to see the latest thing in the career of, you know, if you enjoyed Patty Cakes or Dumplin or I guess what else, Bird Box, any of that other stuff she was in, come check her out in this movie and enjoy it. It sounds like it's going to be a fun time. So we appreciate you joining us and with the time difference from Australia to DC. That's always appreciated. We'll get the word out. I'll either run it either today or I don't know, it's a short turnaround, maybe Monday at the latest, but I'll definitely get this up on the radio for sure.
Remind me of Seth Rogen.
I remind you of Seth Rogen?
Yes. I hope that's not an insult, is it?
No.
I am Seth Rogen. The joke's on you. So. This is my DC alias. That's
a very Seth Rogen thing to say.
There you go. I'll leave it at that.
There you go.
Nice meeting you both. See ya.
Yep. See ya.
See ya.